Okay, so yesterday we... Last day! Crazy. Last day of 11th, 12th grade this year. How's that? Okay. She wasn't having a share schedule. That's it right now. But good. So our learning today continues to be in memory of Rav Lichtenstein, whose yard site is now our time. It's Eretz Yisrael. It was already last night, so that's what I included yesterday as well. And I said yesterday that it says something about Talmud Torah. So he wrote, I don't have it here, I apologize. You guys have Leaves of Faith? Have you seen Leaves of Faith? Do you know about it?
I know about it.
Highly recommended. So once you, I mean, the first thing I would recommend, he did, Leaves of Faith he did, by his light he did not.
Right, sorry.
So the Rav Lichtenstein, there are two like basic books to start with that I would recommend for Rav Lichtenstein.
That's what he talks about too, the two discussions.
Well, yeah, Leaves of Faith is a collection of articles. Right. So one of the articles that's collected in one of the volumes is there, what?
Yamal.
So it's not a direct article, I'm like to the best of my knowledge offhand, but he has the article about whether or not there's an ethic independence of halacha, which touches on those kinds of questions. Yeah, yeah, understands. That's one of his classic articles. I would recommend starting with By His Light, which talks about the sort of the ethos of a Ben Torah, what does it mean to be a Ben Yeshiva, and sort of the basic general themes in what it means to be an Oved Hashem. Very, very beautiful and highly recommended and more accessible than some of Lichtenstein's other writing, which is tough English. And then after that, I would definitely recommend Leaves of Faith, which you have volume 2 is the green one toward the right on the shelf, and then the other one is a red volume, so that's also highly recommended. And that he has got a range of essays. One of the essays that he has in there in volume 1 is, by the way, Leaves of Faith is borrowed from, where are your Tikva Minds? Tikva Minds need to come into play. Leaves of Faith is borrowed from a collection of poems by a famous American author, but it is modified for the religious, from Whitman. Leaves of Grass become Leaves of Faith. And the Hands of Rav Lichtenstein. So you see the background, but it's not just about individualist experience. It's about the American experience. It's about the faith experience. So that is a beautiful title. The first volume is entitled The World of Jewish Learning. The second one is something like The Jewish World of Jewish Living or something like that. And so the first one is about Torah and major themes in Torah, and the second one is just about a range of other topics. So he has an article, Why Learn Talmud, Why Learn Gemara. Called Why Learn Gemara? Very simple question. Of course, Lichtenstein, he gives a complex layered answer. So I recommend it if you're thinking about why we learn Gemara and why it's such a central parsable of our curricula in Yeshivot. But he identifies 4 different factors, and I'm going to share with you four very quick excerpts. Ready? The first one he says that the exposure, the contact, is one that's incredibly energizing. And he says like this, and he points to the fact that the Gemara is not a complete product in a way, and yet it is complete. It's somewhere in between. It's been edited, it's been compiled to summarize the debates, and yet it's open-ended. You start learning it, and you can ask so many questions and take it so much deeper. So he writes as follows. He writes, on every daf, okay guys, just close for a moment, and then we'll open back up to notes. He says like this, on every daf, one feels the freshness of virgin birth. Okay? That's a metaphor, obviously. The angular edge of rough, it's based on Gemara Nechagiga, by the way, which talks about Talmud Torah's luxuriance. You guys know that Gemara Nechagiga on Daf Gimel? Highly recommend it. Gorgeous. Very beautiful. It's connected to Eilu Ve'ilu Dir Elokim Chayim also. It's about the organic growth of Torah, that when we learn, we add sort of a dimension of learning to Shas. It's both closed and open-ended at the same time. Very beautiful Gemara. The angular edge of rough terrain plowed and yet unplowed. The beck of meandering paths charted and yet uncharted. There's nothing distilled, nothing lacquered. The sense of challenge and concomitant invigoration. Is pervasive. I'm sorry I didn't give it to you in front of you. But what he's saying over here is actually, if you read it, you'd understand.
That's
it, the sense of challenge and concomitant invigoration. Concomitant is basically simultaneous. Is pervasive, it's everywhere. So what he's saying is it's not like everything is laid out in front of you and yet it's accessible. Right? If you learn the language, right, it becomes accessible. For you guys, it's accessible, and yet it's almost infinite in terms of the depths that it offers, in terms of the level of understanding, in terms of it's not packaged for you simply and nicely, neatly, and tied with a bow, which means it's harder work, but it also means that there's so much virgin terrain that as a learner, right, as we were saying yesterday, that you're not just receiving a link in the chain, you yourself are becoming, a link in the chain. You almost can transform the Mesorah in a way that, not transform it so it's not recognizable, God forbid, but in a way that you're adding your unique contribution. So that's a very beautiful idea. He also talks about the exposure to the greatness of Chazal. That these were great individuals doesn't mean that they were perfect, but they were brilliant. Just look at Gemara. Ever think about this for a second? Shas is a work of genius. I mean, it's brilliant. It's complex. And I think about following a really difficult Shach Bavataria. Sometimes we have questions. We don't understand what Chazal were thinking, etc. But it's just, and those are good questions that we can answer, but they're brilliant. Just that sense that you're coming in contact with, and not just genius people, but people who are not perfect, but again, people of great morality, people of great ethics, people who are incredible role models for us until today, 2,000 years later. It's pretty impressive. So he writes like this. He says, to open a Gemara is to enter into their, meaning Chazal's, overawing presence, to feel the force of their collective personality. And not as in historical critical modes in order to pass judgments upon them, but as so as to be irradiated, that's a good one, and ennobled by them. Ennobled, right? There's President Joel from YU used to say, right? Ennobled and enabled. Okay. It is to be exposed with a sense of intimacy, to be exposed with a sense of intimacy not only to their discourse, exegesis, aphorisms, or anecdotes, but to themselves. To themselves. At once engaging and magisterial, thoroughly human, and yet overwhelming. Good writer, good English, right? But the idea is, right, you're overwhelmed by that encounter, and it's both humbling and inspiring at the same time. And that's a second reason to learn Gemara. Very powerful. And then he says, third thing he says is he talks about what he calls the substantive nature of Gemara. So he says it's simply an attempt to find truth, and he quotes another explanation there. And then the final one, I think, is the most important, which is what we've spoken about. Rabbi Targum came, he spoke about this as well a little bit. The idea that when you learn Gemara, it's not just encountering a text or ideas, but it's an experience as well. It's an encounter with the Ribono Shel Olam. The Rav, by the way, has a beautiful essay in which he talks about this. He talks about Torah and humility. Why are Tam Torah and humility bound hand in hand? If anything, academics, intellectuals tend to be extremely high on themselves. Anyone ever hear Footnote? Ever hear this movie? It's an Israeli movie. Ever hear this? Footnote is about a father and son who are both in academia, and so there are all sorts of tensions between them. There's a competition between, it's like, it's father and son, but it's cutthroat. It's sort of like a parody of the academic scene. Academics have, not all academics, I know many humble, wonderful human beings, but there's sometimes an association, at least we have in our minds, where it runs the risk of, you learn too much, then you might become too full of yourself. It's not so simple. We should learn and we should study. We should understand as best we can, but it's not so simple. So the Rav talks about Torah and humility. And the encounter with Torah, because it's not the encounter with the text and our own ideas, but it's the encounter with God's ideas. It's mediated through Chazal, mediated through the text. And so therefore, we need to be humble when we enter, and done properly, it is in and of itself a humbling experience. So Rav Aaron picks up on this theme. He says that Judaism has traditionally stressed that Talmud Torah is not to be perceived as a purely intellectual pursuit. It constitutes, rather, a dialogic encounter with the Ribono Shel Olam. What is a dialogic encounter with the Ribono Shel Olam? What does it mean to be dialogic?
Dialogue-like.
What? It is, right, dialogue-esque, as it were. What does that mean? It is like a dialogue. As the characteristics of the dialogue.
Two ways.
What does that mean? So on the one hand, the obvious one is we read the text. It's God talking to us through his text. How does it go the other way, as it were? I thought that was tefila. I understand davening, you're talking to God. What does it mean when you're learning? It's dialogical. You understand that.
The Gemara and the Lama Shemayim.
Yeah, it goes to the same idea, right? In other words, when you're learning, you're contributing your ideas. They become part. If you have a new insight, if it's a legitimate insight, it's really authentic, it's really accurate, right? So that becomes part of the corpus of Torah. Lo bashamayim, he means that by definition. Eilu ve'eilu dhir lo kimchayim means that if you and I, Shai, even my Talmud, have a respectful disagreement, then your position is really a legitimate reading of the Gemara. So that becomes part of the corpus of Talmud Torah. Kol Ma'aseh Talmud Vasa, Kasa L'Chadish, Ne'amar L'Moshe Mi'Sinai. It was all said. What does that mean? That God got up and said, Rabbi Sinensky says Azoy. And Goldman Shai Goldman, or maybe one day Rabbi Shai Goldman. What does Rabbi Goldman hold? Right, holds another issue. Do you think God went to Sinai and he quoted me and you? Maybe. I'd be very honored, but somehow I doubt it. So what's Pshat? What does it mean? Right? So there is such a view that he said literally everything, but I don't think that that's likely, and I'm not sure, frankly, that I would qualify for the list of whose opinions are quoted anyway.
I'm mad.
What?
Check out
the Sparia source sheet. It's an excellent source sheet. Check it out, okay? So with this idea... Yeah. And it's out there. Check it out. Yep. That's cool. So the idea that it's dialogic is that we, in a way, it's our way of contributing to the corpus of Torah. It's a reciprocal relationship. So I think it's a beautiful idea. And it gives a couple of different really beautiful reasons for the importance of the Talmud Torah, right? The idea that it's both humbling and empowering at the same time, that we come into counter, we come into face-to-face, as it were, with Chazal, with these overawing and inspiring personalities, that we find truth through the Torah, and more than anything else, we connect with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So Mirtzah Hashem, we should be Zoche, we should merit to experience our own Talmud Torah in that way. For those that are continuing their formal structure of Talmud Torah, so then in that structure, hopefully beyond, but also even for those who are not going to be in a formal structure, to create your own structures, to make sure that you have your own opportunity to connect with the Ribono Shel Olam, to be Kovia Itim quite seriously. And again, I'm happy to help with that. You guys are also more than capable on your own, but the importance of that encounter with Gemara in particular, and with Torah more generally, I think is a beautiful and important reminder to us all. All right. Yesterday we saw the Mishnah. We very quickly did a summary of the Gemara, and then what did we do?
We talked about reasons.
Reasons, okay, and we gave a range of different reasons. We talked about the Abu Jahan. Shai, you're good?
Yeah.
All right, yeah, excellent, fantastic. Okay. So we gave a range of reasons. We saw Abu Draham about the husband-wife relationship, and we discussed that at some length. We discussed Rav Uziel and Rav Moshe Feinstein. It's not about the wife's relationship with her husband, but more about the wife's relationship with and responsibilities toward her children. And then we talked about Rav Hirsch and Dr. Lamb, about the idea that actually a very different direction that represents either the unique status, religious status of women, or their unique being in their ability to be in tune with time.
Now, you see that. For
yes.
The readiness, or people didn't really care because he was a
Hirsch
and he was controversial
already? Rav Hirsch was quite well respected. He was writing primarily.
I'm saying, like.
Meaning, which part of the community are you asking for?
Yeah, I'm saying, like, he wasn't necessarily, like.
Except in the Haredi community?
Right, anyway. So I don't know how problematic this didn't be.
You don't know how what?
I asked the question, was he pushback from this? And I kind of answered my own question is, considering the world he came from and most of his positions that he already took, this might not necessarily be so radical.
Right. It's more complicated than that. Remember, he was certainly modern in some ways, but
it was also very
intelligent. It was also, right.
But
it's all Elstritz and all that. And also, he wasn't Zionist, too, which is really striking. He was... We should be honest about that also. I mean, he was anti-Zion, but he wasn't, I mean, he was not a card-carrying. And he overlapped, I think, with Ruth's Feverish Kalisher and Ruhid Alkali, who there were proto-Zionists living at the time, but that wasn't his. He was very committed to being a good German Jew, for lack of a better term. It was a different time, obviously. It was a long time before World War II, but it's complicated. But yeah, in other ways, obviously, he was more engaged with and embracing of the modern world, maybe in that world to which he spoke, in the language he spoke, and the people to whom he was speaking. Nowadays, though, the Olam Haredi has accepted Rav Hirsch to a large degree, right? And some have reinterpreted Torah in Derech Eretz. One of the polemics of our generation has been, Breuers holds from him.
Right.
Breuers has gone. Right, exactly. It's a good example, but Breuers has, gone in a certain direction. The more recent one of the Rabbanim of Breuers suggested at one point that Torah Derech Eretz was only a Bediyevet, it's a Horasha, it was only for its time, but wasn't really an ideal. There have been, and others feel that that's completely inaccurate, and that's just convenient reworking of the Hirsch. But it's interesting who gets discarded and who gets reinterpreted and interpreted and all of that.
I like the way he dressed.
For Hirsch?
You see the picture of him with the hat and like little white things like this?
Yeah, that's very sharp. Which one do you have there?
Interesting.
All right, good. So the next thing we're going to do is to tackle some of the questions of scope. So there are five primary categories I'm going to look at, and we're going to start with Bris Mila. We are short on time, obviously, so and this is our last official shiur together. So, therefore, I'm going to do some stuff outside that I would have otherwise done inside in order to make sure that we get through the basics of the sugya. All right, so I'm going to move along and bear with me as we move at a relatively quick pace. So the first question we want to look at is with regard to the scope of Mila, regard to the scope of Mitzvah Shehas Mangrama, and what exactly Mangrama means. Look at the example of Mila. We know in the Gemara in Kiddushin right here, Nachafetanah, which is why we're starting with Mila, we know that the Gemara teaches that the halacha is that a father is obligated to circumcise his son, whereas a mother is exempted from circumcising her son. And the Gemara brings a source, that is the basis for exempting the mother from the mitzvah of Bris Mila. Along the way, the Gemara, I believe it's in the excerpt that I gave you, the Gemara says that if a father does not circumcise his son, then the next group that is obligated is the Beis Din, and if the Beis Din does not do so, so then when he becomes a bar mitzvah, that's how the Gemara is generally understood, he becomes obligated in his own mitzvah of Bris Mila.
The mother isn't. It doesn't say some the Beis Din.
Oh, very good. So, there is a Zashita of the Baal HaMakna, the Sefer HaMakna, that claims that a mother is obligated qua Beis Din. In other words, in the same category, fundamentally. So you are mechaving to the Sefer HaMakna. Well, that's a little bit of a different discussion. In other words, the point is that it's incumbent upon the community, and whoever either represents the community or is closest is obligated. The argument, by the way, for those who wouldn't say that, would say something like, it's incumbent on the community. Who are the representatives of the community? The Beis Din more so than the mother.
What section of the source is this?
This is under what says three definition of time bound, then A says Mila in smaller text. Okay, good. So that's an aside anyway. Anyhow, so the Rishonin, starting with Tosos and then the Chachmei Sfarad all the way down, ask the basic question. They say, why don't we say that the reason that women are exempted from Bris Mila is because the mitzvah says she has grama, and that in two senses. Number one, because the mitzvah exists only really on the eighth day, but after that you can do it, but it's less ideal. Since the ideal, and you can say this, by the way, in two ways, right? You can say it only begins on the eighth day, and ideally, it should be formed only on the eighth day and not afterward, assuming that the baby is healthy. So isn't a mitzvah seish hazmangam in terms of the scope of these? And number two, what about, according to the view that we generally adopt, namely that Mila is nohag only by yom and not by laila, so there too, for that reason, it should be a mitzvah seish shehazmangrama. So Dosos asks both these questions right here. Al Tarimasko, so velo sa, and Tosos answers each one differently. He says, what about the first one? He answers that the Yishalar came to Miyom Ashmini Bahala in La Hefsik Lav's Mangrama Hu. So he says you can do the Mila afterwards. True, it's only kasher from day 8 and on. However, after that point, you can really do it at any time, therefore, it does not qualify as Zmangrama. This answer of Tosos is highly significant because it makes a couple of important assumptions, possibly about the Seisha Zmangrama as well as about Mila, right? In terms of Mila, so Yesh Lachkor, we should examine the question, what is the relationship between Mila on Yom HaShmini and Mila after Yom HaShmini? What is the relationship between the mitzvah Mila Bezmana and mitzvah Mila Shelo Bezmana? This is a larger Chakira, which requires analysis across the board. Some of the primary sugyos of the mitzvah of Mila actually appear in Masechet Shabbos, in Perek Rabbi Eliezer to Mila, which starts off about whether or not it's permissible for, just like Mila's Doche Shabbos, are Machshire Mila. Doche Shabbos are the preparations for the performance of Mila. Doche Shabbos, are you allowed to sharpen a Mila knife in order to perform it properly on Shabbos? Are you allowed to carry a Mila knife through Rishus HaRabim in order to perform a Mila in a situation where you don't have an Eruv, or you're in a Rishus HaRabim Doraisa, and you're not able to carry the baby or the instruments? Otherwise, what can you do? So that's what it's got. And there are many of the halachos are discussed in that Gemara, and there are a couple of sugyos and a couple of pieces in the Gemara and the Mishnah there that go to this question. What is the relationship to Mila on day 8 and Mila afterward? Plausibly, although not necessarily, but quite possibly, Tosos assumes what about the relationship between those two? Greater continuity or greater discontinuity? What would you say? Mila on day 8 and Mila afterward. Right, because Tosos is saying you can view them as together in the end of the day. So even Tosos Lechoro would agree with the Evid. So you have to refine terms, and it's a little bit beyond the scope of our discussion. But I think there still remains a legitimate question as to whether they're seen as sort of one's a Chalchila, one's with the Evid, but they're fundamentally the same mitzvah. It's just that that one mitzvah, that one obligation, is best to perform on day 8. Or it's almost like there are conceptually two obligations. There's a mitzvah of mila bizmana, and if you're not able to perform mila on day 8, so then there's another obligation that kicks in of mila shelo bizmana, and that's a separate obligation. Obviously, it's part of the same mitzvah midoraisa, but you can see conceptually that would be a different formulation, even though it's lechatchila b'di'eved in both scenarios. Right? Everyone agrees that all things are equal, yom hashmini is lechatchila, and still Tosfos, by putting them together, may indicate that it's really the same mitzvah rather than sort of a separate obligation. So that's the first answer in Tosfos, and that answer appears, I believe, also in one of the responses in Tosfos and Megillah and Daf Chafam Aleph and Maskil Dechsiv, which we'll come back to in just a moment. With regards to the other question, so Tosfos says, well, that's easy. We're assuming simply that what? That the mitzvah of Mila is, no, I guess? When? Right. Bein Bayom, Uvein Balayla. So then Tosfos grants that if Mila were limited to the daytime, what? Yeah, Mila Shelo, sorry. Mila Shelo Bizmana, and that would be sufficient. That's right. Which also, by the way, connects to the relationship between Mila Bizmana and Mila Shelo Bizmana. In other words, that too seems to assume a certain continuity.
Does Mila Bizmana imply that there is a Zman?
There's no such thing as Mila Bizmana. What do you mean?
He said that only Mila Shelo Bizmana.
Oh, the fact that there's that discrepancy, yes.
The idea of Mila Bizmana implies that it is a Zman.
Everyone would agree with that.
And therefore, it's supposed to say.
But he's saying that there's sort of, it's viewed, again, fundamentally as the same mitzvah. Like, for example, Tashlumin. How do you understand Tashlumin in Tefillah? Pashus in Tashlumin in Tefillah is that it's like, if you missed your this obligation, then there's one more obligation, as it were, a way to do it. Now, another way to see Tashlumin is sort of a more flexible, if bidi'evid, view on Zmani Tefillah. Right, like, oh,
but there is a limit.
How chassid might be. Sorry, limit. I couldn't resist. What?
Last day.
Not so. What? Even on another day, I'm not willing to say that. It all comes out. All the chassidus can be used as lamdos for the sugi of tashlumin. All these crazy shitas that Rabbi Sinensky has. What? Habakkuk. It's all. I've been hiding my chaos behind my ears for all these. My sphere of
that would be crazy.
I need sphere
of like a scam, like some rabbi was hiding his chaos. He was actually a chassid, but nobody knew.
All right. Relevant to Ashrala, original. The other way. The latter verse. He says, oh, it's not so critical for us. He says, some chassidim don't even have it. It's a very, okay, well. You'll tell us what the psak is later, Mayor. That's an accurate representation.
The Arizal.
What?
The Arizal did not have that.
Okay? Good. All right, so that's one Tosos. There's another Tosos. Interesting. I do want to continue that conversation. I'd be curious too. Anyhow, so Tosos Megillah asked the question. He quotes it in the name of Rabbeinu Ephraim. And he says, by the way, it's the same Rabbi Ephraim. He says, you're not allowed to get drunk on Purim, but that's a separate discussion. Could have a more. You guys remember Rabbi Ephraim? Can we do that today? Together? Rabbi Ephraim holds like this. You know how the Gemara first says, and then tells the story of Rabba and Rabbi Zera. Right? And that they went, and that Rabba shachti le Rabbi Zera, that he shachted him. And then he wanted to come back to Rabbi Zera for the Purim Suda the next year, and he said, Lo bechol shaita v'shaita esrachish nisa. Right? There's not necessarily a miracle every single year. Thanks. Tchias amisim once, not another time. So Rabbi Ephraim says, what's the purpose of the juxtaposition of these two stories? So he said it's because the latter is a commentary on the former. He's saying that it's true that in theory there would have been a preference or even an obligation, theoretically speaking, of but in fact, the Gemara then comes along and says, but it's too dangerous, and therefore you should not do so. When I was in TABC, Rabbi Yosef Adler would always say, we pass on like Rabbi Ephraim. And if you have a problem with that, you get up to Shemayim on Mi'av Esrim, and you think of Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to ask you, no, why didn't you on Purim get to the level of Adli Yadman or Aram Varach Mordechai? You can just send them to Rabbi Adler and say, I'll take your Avera, no problem. Send God to me, and I'll take your demerit. I have no no objection to that whatsoever. That was always the pasuk of Rabbeinu Ephraim. Much reason to think that even if we didn't pass him like Rabbeinu Ephraim b'zman haGemara, that we pass him Rabbeinu Ephraim for people whose minds are still fully, not yet fully developed, and that maybe there's reason to pass him like Rabbeinu Ephraim after the invention of something called the automobile, which did not result in deaths in the same way. Bisman HaGemara, for very obvious reasons. Anyhow, so Rabbeinu Ephraim. So Rabbeinu Ephraim here is quoted by Tosfos as having asked the question. He says, I don't understand. And so he gives another answer here, which I think is quite fascinating. And his answer here, and it's specifically in context of the question, right? Specifically in context... Right. Actually, I think he leaves the question open, right? He just says generally that, right? In this one, he just asks generally, isn't it misasayishas man rama? And here he gives the answer that we would have thought that women are nonetheless obligated in milah because it's a misasayishas sheyish bo, kares. And therefore, it is a particularly severe and maybe significant or central mitzvah, and therefore we would have thought that women are obligated. He says, not only is it a mitzvah say sheish bakares, but he adds v'nichrisu aleha yud gimel brisos, that 13 different covenants were forged with regard to the mitzvah of milah. This is based on Gemara Nedarim. I want to say that Lama Beis, the Gemara uses this language, and the Gemara is pointing out that the terminology of bris is used that number of times, I believe, in the story of Avram at the end of Parshas Lech Lecha. So in other words, it seems it's not just a question of the onesh, because nichrisu lehayigim ubrisos, but rather that the chiyuv kares is indicative of what? What about bris milah?
It's an outlier.
Okay, it's an outlier. It's different than other mitzvahs. Good. It's an exception, and more than that, not only is it an outlier, I think that's true, it's an outlier due to its centrality, its significance. In other words, this is a mitzvah of bris, of covenant between Hashem Baruch Hu and his people. Right? So maybe you would have thought that it's treated a little bit differently. What's the other mitzvah say Sheish Bo Karis? It's only one. Only two altogether. Close. What you meant is that's a Lotaseh, right? Instead? Right. Okay, the Pesach is other mitzvah Sheish Bo Karis. And Kol HaEzrach Yisrael, right? Similar language when it comes to Yom Pesach, women are obligated in that as well, so that's the basis for the Havamina. Now this, as we'll see for all of these, it's not clear to what extent the scope questions go back to the question of the reason. In other words, do this regular structure, this is an interesting question, guys, what do you think? Do the regular structures, can we use the same structure of a sugya here? Usually we've developed a chakira very often, and then we have a fair variety of nafkaminos. So this is an interesting one. Does the tam, does the reason directly impact on the scope? Right? In other words, here it's not like the first ones were just reason. Same way to the tam mitzvah, right? Where do we see that the tam mitzvah might not always impact on the details of the practical halacha? Anyone know which sugya grapples with that question? Sugya in a couple of places in Shas, Sanhedrin, in the second parak in particular, and a couple of other places. There's Machlokes Rabbi Shimon and the Chachamim, whether or not Darshina Taima Dekra. Familiar with that debate? A very important argument. Whether or not Darshina Taima Dekra. Rabbi Shimon says yes. And the question is essentially this. If the Torah gives you reasoning explicitly, then the assumption is that that can be used in not only understanding the machshava behind the Torah, but in determining the details of the halacha. But let's say the Torah doesn't give you a particular reason for it, but you're a Rishon. Congratulations, you graduated. And so now we've appointed you, we've elevated you to the status of a Rishon, and we say, right, what do you think? And so you give a particular reason for the tam hamitzvah. Can that tam, which is not explicit in the Torah, but is your conjectures, your suggestions, your svara, can that be used to impact or to determine the scope of a halacha?
No, because that's like saying that, you know, the reason for kosher is X, and therefore you don't have to...
So you run the danger of eliminating it, right? On the other hand, if that's really the Ratzon HaTorah, if that's really what the Torah is talking about, then maybe it would make sense to not to eliminate mitzvah altogether, but maybe it should impact on the scope to some degree. Now, again, not in all cases, not across the board, not to say mitzvah is no longer relevant, but at least to say that it can impact on its applicability in a particular scenario. So that's a basic question of whether or not there's shinan time in the kra. This is not time of the kra, but it's kind of time of the halacha. Kind of a similar question. The sugyos never tell us why. And in fact, if anything, make the opposite argument. Here, there's a pasuk that's specifically associated with it, right? Or at least it's right. It's a drush. It's right. They're drushos, right? There's some sort of zeras hakasav. It's not even a direct halacha that Torah taught you. It's derived from this drusha. It's compared, right? The tefillin and so on and so forth. So maybe these are nice svaros, but in the end of the day, that's where they end. They're ideas, but they're not going to actually impact on the scope of the halacha. So that, I think, is a legitimate question. And interestingly enough, the Rishonim do not explicitly connect between any tam, like the Abu Draham isn't quoted by the Rishonim, right? He's a later Rishon, but I'm saying it's not you know, that svara is not introduced by the Rishonim in context of their discussion. So maybe it's a separate issue, and they really can't be viewed together. Still, I think it's worth wondering aloud, is this Svara of Tosos, for example, at all related to any of the things that we're talking about? Right? Like, for example, is it possible to say, right, you could at least formulate in context of the Svara. So, for example, you'd say, we're going to, for the Abu Draham, you could say it like this, we're going to exempt a woman from its Sesei, Shazman Grama, of relative significance, of some significance, because we don't want it that, you know, that could really interfere with Shalom Bayis, and Shalom Bayis trumps that. But mitzvah, shenichusu olah yigimu brisos, they're already, that is going to have greater stature, and that's going to trump her obligations or husbands, or despite her concerns to Shalom Bayis. In the end of the day, how can we not include her in this particular mitzvah? Like, you could formulate it that way, right? Or with Rav Moshe and Rav Uziel, you'd say, okay, for regular mitzvah, say Shazman Grama, so they're going to say, for most of those, we're going to say, okay, responsibilities toward her family come first. What are you going to say? That mitzvah sasei sheishbo karis. They're also, we're going to say, no, this is of such significance that here, despite her busy schedule, the importance, the critical importance of caring for her family members, etc., nonetheless, we're going to obligate her in this mitzvah. So you can see, you can begin to formulate it in context of the svara. For Hirsch, it might be more difficult to say it this way. You could. Right? How would you say it?
I mean, a woman doesn't need to perform the quote unquote minor mitzvah to say Shazman Grama because she has this either natural superior spirituality or
right.
sensitivity to time, but the central mitzvahs, she still needs them.
So right. She needs them. Right. One way to say it is needs them, or you can even say, even if she didn't need them, the point is they're about, if it's about Christos Bris, so then. Right. By the way, you can also wonder, even if she doesn't perform it directly, maybe the mitzvah is sort of like there's a family unit element here, although I don't know if you can prove that. It's just, I'm wondering about that. I don't have any evidence for that, so might be wrong. Okay, this question is also asked by Tosos and Yevamos, right? And he also has the lashon that we saw earlier that he says, Yishlon Gelezer Rabbi Shimon Yitzrich V'had Dinim Ol Lishmona. Right, this question, Lo Chashe Zman Grama Kivin De Mishmona Veilach Kol Shaita Zmano. So again, the conflating as far as similar to what we saw back in Kiddushin. Who gives a different answer than the answers in Tosos that we've seen so far?
Ramban.
Excellent. So the first one that's different is the Ramban and the Ritva, who are saying identical things or similar things, something like that. And basically, their Svara is something that you guys found unexpected and a little bit unusual in Seder. Right? The Ramban and the Ritva say that there's a fundamental distinction between a mitzvah of your guf and a mitzvah that's incumbent on someone else's guf. When it comes to a mitzvah that's incumbent upon you directly, kigon tefillin and the like, so there we say that mitzvah sheshazman grama nashim peturos. But you might have said with regard to Mili, which is really incumbent upon her acting toward another individual, namely her son. So therefore, I might have said that she is obligated in that mitzvah. And the proof to the pudding is what? Whose obligation in Milas Aven? Right? Midi dehava a? Says the Rabban, midi dehava a? Just like the.
On himself?
It's. Yeah, and that is consistent with the fact that midi dehava a. Based in Shechayav and Lamul, remember, right? Both Ramban and I believe the Ritva, right? Yeah, the Ritva invoke this point. Right? They both make exactly this point. Here's language of the Ritva says it may be slightly different. Ikal lemeimar dehasam hu mitzvah dinafsha aval hacha b'mitzvah divna hava amina demechayva dilo gar ami based in. Shai is kind of like your point also. Dilo gar ami based in. How is she any less than based in?
Right.
Right? So the truth is that for the Ritva, it's possible to kind of say it in that way. For the Ramban, however, and possibly for the Ritva as well, because he also has the beginning language of mitzvah dinafsha versus mitzvah divna. So how do you understand the Svara for that idea? How did you guys explain this? How did you guys were asking about it in the Seder?
What?
What
did we say?
We didn't say it. I'm asking you.
I'm not sure the question was.
How do you understand this further than Ramban? What's the logic of his position? As you guys said, if anything, I would say the opposite should be the case. Right? There should be even greater pressure to perform mitzvah than nafsha. Mitzvah for someone else would seem to be less, essentially, less incumbent upon me. So it's ironic. It's backwards. Right? If anything, I would have said that she's obligated in the mitzvah than nafsha, her own mitzvah. You want to exempt her from something, exempt her from someone else's mitzvah, but her own mitzvah?
If you hold like her perch, for example, and then you know her being spiritually superior would not exempt her from things that you know it's her responsibility to do to other people.
Right. So it could be. Again, I'm not sure whether or not it's legitimate in this context to introduce it. So I think I'm leaving it open intentionally.
Right. But
if you do, I think it could be something like
whole time. So I mean, like the whole like she doesn't.
Right. In other words, I think. The point is like this. The first camp sees with Luchora would define Zman Grama in practical terms. That's how I would say it. And this is going to be relevant for some of the other examples as well. Right? In other words, Lemaisa, is it going to take away from her other responsibilities? Lemaisa will take away from her husband. Lemaisa will take away from her children. Right? In other words, that according to the first camp of the Svara or the Tam for Mitzvah Seisha Zman Grama, we might be more likely to see Mitzvah Seisha Zman Grama as a determined by practical busyness. That would be the criteria. It's not a conceptual or theoretical category. So abstractions will be beside the point. Don't tell him, oh, Lundus, it's her mitzvah, it's someone else's mitzvah, it's incumbent upon her, only because really it's his mitzvah, not hers, and therefore, since it, right, Mitzvah Seisha Zman Grama applies to her, but not to someone else's mitzvah, the Haraya, the Basin also do the same mitzvah. That's an abstract category. Maybe for a verse, or maybe, by the way, if I just divorce it from any of the Ta'amim, and just say, it's a theoretical category. She's exempted from Mitzvah Seisha Zman Grama. This isn't fundamentally her mitzvah. This is the son's mitzvah, which is just then mutal on her, just like it is on Basin. She's Logarmi Basin, like the Ritva says. Right. And then maybe it has to do with the lumdus of Bris Milah, right? In other words, there's a lot of lumdus about this question. How do you understand, even with regard to the father's obligation? Is it the pshat that the father has an obligation? Or is it the pshat that really there's an obligation for the son to have a bris milah? That obligation for the son to have a bris devolves first on the father, and then on the community slash basin, and then on the son himself. And only that. Maybe similarly, and that's a basic chakir with regard to milah, and there's a lot of lumdus around that as well. And I went through every double galley. Also, there's an article about that, if not research. But that's a classic chakir razzle, so maybe it's really contingent on that. So again, if I hold like the first svara, then l'chora this distinction doesn't make any sense. Again, if I hold like the first one, I think it should infuse, the time should infuse our learning of the scope of the sugya. If I hold like a first, maybe it could be conceptual. And if I just have a pure halachic model, then maybe you could say that she's exempted from her own mitzvahs. But this, but the svara should be the kalachomer. Okay, but that's. You're looking at it from two. You're infusing the tam too much into the geder hadin. This is a geder hadin that exists as an independent legal category. Think of it as a legal category rather than as something that directly flows in halacha from the tam hadavar. And you can see why this is also going to be relevant to Sfiras Omer, possibly, and to Kiddush Levana. The practical versus abstract or theoretical definition of what constitutes zman grama. Are we asking the question, lemaisa is she busy or lemaisa is she not? Like, is this going to take our time? Or are we saying no, we're willing to view this in sort of conceptual theoretical categories? And that's going to be, I think, a common thread that runs throughout a number of these nafkaminos. Okay, there's one additional explanation, which is, I don't know if you guys saw the Tosfos Rit, source 16, do you guys see that inside?
Yeah.
Oh, because we never discussed it together. What? No. Okay, we don't have time to read the whole thing, but I think you might have misunderstood. That's in his question. He doesn't say Zman Kavua later on.
That's what he started out by saying.
Right, but his answer. What's his answer?
So.
No, so it's not. That's not what he said. With the toilet, maybe I don't remember, but the way I understood the Rid is that the Rid is saying, at least in part, he says that he goes to the other piece of the 8 days. And Tosfos focuses only on the aftermath of the 8 days, but he also focuses on the lead up to the 8th day.
In what sense? You're saying that, like, since it's, like, not based on a date, but rather it's, like, you know, just based on, like, it being 8 days from, like, a point in time. It's confusing, I feel like.
I think it's more than that. I think he says that, but I think the reason he says that is because the father's obligation is not only to perform a milah, to arrange for someone else to actually perform the maisa hamilah. Or, put it this way, in the obligation of the father to ensure that the son has a milah, the preparations are an essential part of the father's mitzvah. He says that, third line down in the tshuva, toward the end of the line, last two words in that line, avalav shetiva, avarili sasek, b'milas b'no, ha'esek ha'hu ein lo zman. Says the preparations for the milah, those are not bound by time. It's true the maisa hamilah is only at one time, but the mitzvah of the aval haben is broader, or the mitzvah right the other way around. The mitzvah of the father to perform the milah is broader than just ensuring the act itself is completed. He says shabim bayom uvim balayla yitrach v'yachin sorche milas bino. Says it's not a mitzvah to say shazman grama because really the father's obligation exists all 8 days, both day and night. He makes a phone call on the third night to a mohel and says, "I'm looking for someone to circumcise my son." That's part of the mitzvah samila. He picked up the phone at night. So you should passel it. So no milah slayla. Even worse, on day three. Obviously, it's absurd. No, the point is, the din of the daytime is limited to the maisa hamila. The maisa hamila has certain limitations, but the mitzvah sa'av is broader than that. The mitzvah of the father is not just to ensure or to perform the maisa hamila, but to ensure more broadly the performance of the milah, and that includes all the preparations as well. This is the view of the Tosafot read here in this piece, which is a very important one. It is more famously attributed to the son of the Orzar, which is we've seen two Maharach or Zaruas. We saw one by Shlichos, and there's another one, Simon Yud Aleph, I didn't give you on the source sheet, is more about Mila than is about Mitzvah Seishas Mangroma, but this view is classically attributed to the Maharach or Zaruah, who theorizes that the Mitzvah Samila is not just to perform the act of the Mila, but rather all the preparations, all the king's horses, and all, you know, all of that is part of the Mitzvah Samila, and it's a preparatory or causative, it's a totsa-oriented mitzvah, but not just one focus on the actual mila itself, but on the preparations as well. That's his theory. It's the classic view of the Maharach or Zohar. But the Tosafot Rit is saying basically the same story here in order to account for the mitzvah sasesha as mangroma point. So that's important in that direction as well. Now, this theory that we, or this question, this chakira, as to whether we should view mitzvah sasesha as mangroma as practical, in other words, tachlis, is this time-bound or not, or versus using abstractions such as the svara of the Ramban, and the Ritva in particular, this might help to account for some other examples or anomalies with regard to mitzvos to say shehazman grama, mitzvos that seem to be in Shai's language outliers. Okay, so Talmud Vasek Asu B'Chadish. Apparently, either literally or figuratively, the term outliers was said. Okay. It was, like according to that, it was in Hebrew. It was in Lashon HaKodesh. It would be translated. Rav Lichtenstein has an article when she says explicitly, despite the fact that there is a minority or a view to the contrary, he thinks that the primary view is that it can't be taken literally. It doesn't mean that God got up and for 40 days and 40 nights he cited every single conversation in every shir room for until eternity. So that's not what it says. It says that if God gave him the principles of Torah, and latent within those principles of Torah was all the Torah that would ever be discussed. So that's his preferred reading. Anyhow, so the next question, the next outlier possibly, is Sfiras HaOmer, as we saw. So there's a question, right? The Omer are women obligated in the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer, and the Pashto says that they should be exempted. Right? And that indeed is the consensus, at least in the Torah. There's reason to think that women are obligated because they've accepted it on their own, and therefore there's some sort of chiyuv based on minhag, or some sort of quasi-drabanan, a similar argument by Shofar, by the way. Some try to use this to say they can be motzi as a rabbin in such a case, but that's not the pashtus at all. That's not an argument we generally accept. But maybe there can be some notion that they're obligated, and just like men accepted Ma'ariv as Zechiyos in general, so too maybe women. There's a similar idea that Kiblu Alayos certain mitzvos, and there's reason to think that that applies by Seres Omer. But Midoraisa, at least, in terms of the primary level of law, so you would think L'chora to mitzvah Seisha Azman Grama, and then indeed is the Pesach of the Rambam in multiple places, in Sefer Mitzvos, and in the end of Perek Zayin of Elasun Musafin, as we saw. So for example, there he says, I give you in Source 17, it says, called Ishus Nizrael, Uvachomakum Chosma, and Vinashim Bavadam Turumina. That's Mitzvah Seisha Azman Grama, presumably, and therefore they are exempt. That's the Rambam says, and that's probably what the Pashas is. Because, after all, number one, according to some Rishonim at least, it's preferable to count at night. Number two, more to the point, it spans a specific 49-50-day period in the calendar, so there's that time element. And then, there's a separate 24-hour obligation of counting each and every day. These are a lot of good reasons, L'chor, to say that this is in Mitzvah Azman Grama. And yet, as we said, the Ramban in Kiddushin, right here, right before our sugya on Laman Gimel and Mevez, is citing the list, gives a list, right, really commenting back on ultimately on the Mishnah's list. He says that that the sugya has left out many examples of mitzvah saseh she'azman grama and mitzvah saseh she'lo hazman grama. And on the list of mitzvah saseh she'lo hazman grama, she'azman grama, the Ramban lists, among many others, Sfiras Omer. We said you can analyze the Ramban in one of two ways. You can see it in context of the other mitzvahs they list and see, are there other patterns that give us some insight into the logic of the Ramban? You can also look at Sfiras HaOmer independently and see what might incline us to say that this is a mitzvah say Shalom Azman Grama. Now this Ramban, we said it was so surprising that there's a tradition, quote, in the name of Chaim Brisker, that he thought that this could not have been the opinion of the Ramban, it must have been a Talmud Torah. The Beis Yosef, by the way, sometimes does this, he'll say, he wants a discounted opinion, but he doesn't want to say that that a Rishon got a said something that he finds to be so absurd. So he says, Talmud Toa, right? It wasn't really the Ri in Tosos, it was a later Tosos, Baal HaTosos, or students of Baal HaTosos, who was copying the Tosos down, and he added his own shtickle, or miswrote it, or had a different manuscript, or what have you, that sort of thing, right? So, and without evidence, that takes a lot of boldness to say that. It's not always so convincing. But that's what they quote in the name of Rav Chaim. At least that's one tradition. There might be other traditions in the name of Rav Chaim in terms of this. Rav Lichtenstein, actually, I found, has an article. It's fortuitous. I didn't even realize that we'd be learning it on the Day of the Art site. But Rav Aron in Source 19, actually, I gave you a Hebrew article from the VBM. And he quotes Rav Chaim as holding that there are two dinim in Sfiras Omer. There's one mitzvah to count the Omer, and there's another mitzvah, which is that Klal Yisrael, Ecclesiastes Israel, as it were, sanctifies the holiday, sanctifies Shavuot, by counting from the Omer to the Shtei Halacha. So it's like almost like a quasi-din Kiddush HaChodesh, as it were, that's applied to Shavuot. You have to sanctify it. Like a Beis Din sanctifies the Yovel. There's a din of Sfira. Right? And they, what? The Chiyuv of Iviyachid, or maybe even the Sivur, just a Chiyuv Sfira. There's one din Sfira. Maybe you could say it's a prepared to Matan Tori, to whatever it is, but halachically it's defined as a mitzvah of Sfira, of counting. And the other obligation is not just an obligation of counting in its own right, it's counting that is functional, that actually is created, it generates the Kedusha Sayom of Shavuos, Klal Yisrael, or something, right, so on. He says in a couple of different ways. He says maybe you can distinguish along these lines between the mitzvah of counting days and the mitzvah of counting weeks. Rabbi Yerucham famously holds that there's a separate obligation of counting weeks. Rav Aron doesn't want to say it that way, but he says maybe you could say it that way. Right? Maybe you could also say it's there are two partios and it's connected to that. One of our friends and graduates, Shim Dicker, actually gave a shiur at LMS over Yontif, and he spoke about this. On was it the seventh day? Honestly, it was the seventh day ago. Shim gave a shiur on B'tim HaChamarev on why there are two different parshios. What an emor versus re'eh, and what's the difference between them? It's a very interesting thing to look at, and the question of these versus weeks, and is that the difference? Is there an agricultural element and a religious element, which is part of how he took it, but That's a famous discussion. So Rav Aharon wants to use this to explain a couple of things. And he quotes the Rav was speaking up on this as well. So I think actually, sorry, this part that I'm about to say, he's quoting from the Rav, based on Rav Chaim's Yisud, that there are these two elements in this Sira. So he uses this to explain two problems. Problem number one is the whole question of counting during the night versus counting during the day. Right, so Machlokes HaRishonim, this is the Hag and Tosfos, some big discussion. If you forget at night, can you still count the next day? What do we do?
We say you can do it without a bracha.
You do it again without a bracha. So the question is, Mimanov Shach. Which one is it? Are we, if we're postulating that really you can only count at night, then why even bother counting during the day? And more than that, we hold that what? That you don't lose the count. Right? We hold, well, you don't say a bracha, which implies it's a lacking mitzvah, but it's not enough that you lose the count. So what's pshat? So there are different explanations. It could be it's really just a pshara, sort of like a quasi-suffix, a small-level suffix, something like that. But he says that no, that there are two dinim. And so the point is that what essentially, if it's you're talking about the ma'aseh ha-mitzvah, that first din, that's only balayla. But to create the context with which to celebrate Shavuos, that just requires us noting the passing of every single 24-hour day. So he says that's the pshat. He says the birchas ha-mitzvah was niskana on the personal mitzvah, not on like the sanctifying, because it's the ma'aseh ha-mitzvah, the parmenonis ha-mitzvah. So there, it's only at night. So that's not just like it's a suffix and therefore it's a pshara position. No, they're two dinim. All right, it's a great Priska argument. Svei dinim, right? Svei dinim and Sresa Omer. You have one without the other. So therefore, the bracha is only on the first din. So therefore, that's only at night. So you forget the night, you can count the next day. But she says, nonetheless, right? If you're talking about creating the baseline for Shavuot, so then you can still count. Now, the only thing this doesn't explain, and there's svaros, but I just want to point it out right now, is you still have to explain. So then, why can you still pick up the count with the bracha? If the first din is the one with the bracha, and that one you've lost entirely, in other words, you separate them entirely, then maybe you should have thought that you can no longer recite a bracha, and you just count without a bracha moving forward. I have some thoughts about that, but there's not a sure answer as Omer, but putting it out there. The second point, though, is he comes to the question of the chiyuv of women. It's a mitzvah sezeisha as mangrama. So how can the Ramban say such a shocking thing? Right? So he... This is Rav Lichtenstein quoting the Rav based on Rav Chaim's two dinim in Sira. Rav Chaim had this idea that there are these two elements in the mitzvah of Sira Omer, and Rav Aharon cited the Rav as having used that to answer these two questions. Question one was what we just said. Question two is how can the Ramban say that women are obligated in Sira isn't in a mitzvah sasei shazman grama? So he says again, mitzvah sasei shazman, there are two dinim in the mitzvah. Women are obligated. In theory, women would have been obligated in both. The individual obligation, the ma'aseh ha-mitzvah that is personal, right? It's kind of similar to the Ramban in a way, in the Ritva, right? That's personal, that they're exempted from. Nonetheless, women are part of Klal Yisrael in the sense that they too are equally have a chelek in Shavuos and Mekadeh, you know, and so on and so forth.
How can they say a bracha then?
What?
How can they say a bracha?
How can women say a bracha? So
like
maybe... Maybe that's us. It's not so simple that they can say a bracha. And in fact, Rav Avadya Yosef paskins that women should not say a bracha because he holds that it's mitzvah sei shazman grama. Women are exempt from it. He holds like the Rambam, who says that we'll come to in a few minutes, God willing. I'm trying to rush and get there. That women do not say bracha mitzvah sei shazman grama. They can't make a bracha. But you're saying, even so, according to the Ramah, l'chora, you should say they shouldn't, right? I don't know. And these are connected, both about the bracha. I don't know. Maybe you have to tweak it with regard to the bracha a little bit. Again, I have some ideas, but let's leave them aside for now. That's a good question. Okay, anyhow, so that's how he says it. However, there is a third explanation. In other words, the first explanation is kind of an explanation at all. The Ramban never said such a thing. Okay. Second explanation is that there are two dinim and it's connected to the national obligation. That's basically what Rav Lichtenstein was saying.
Right.
Women are obligated in that second din, they're exempted from the first din.
One of them obligates women, one of them doesn't.
No. Yeah. They're obligated in the first and not the second. Right. Just
the, then the second, not the first.
Second not the.
It's a type of.
It says because they're
two.
Obligated. What? Forget therefore. He's just explaining. He's accounting for their own back.
But what are the practical ramifications
of saying that they're obligated in the second at all?
They're just obligated. Look, if you say like weeks versus days, you could try to say something like that. You could. It depends on how you structure those two mitzvahs in general. Well, however you view more generally the difference between those two is going to impact on it. The one thing kind of leaves that open. He kind of says maybe distinguishing days and weeks and other distinctions, but he's not convinced that those...
We saw it, right?
Yeah.
Where was it?
Is it So, right, he plays with that.
Yeah, kind of mentions that.
Yeah, that's related to that. So there's a third answer which many Achronim give. I want to say, no problem, I want to say I saw it in the Studiash at one point, although I didn't get a chance to look back in this context, but it's definitely found in the Avni Nezer, the Sukkachavara. Sukkachavara was a great, great Langdon. He wrote an extremely important Sefer Nechal Shabbos called the Eglay. You don't know? The Eglay Sukkachavara is not correct. The Eglay Tal is an unbelievable book on Hilchos Shabbos. I strongly recommend it. He also has a beautiful Hakdama too. It's one of the, when you learn Shabbos, like in Gush Esir, they learn probably a lot of Eglay Tal. A lot of Mekoreshim probably have a lot of Eglay Tal that's here in Gush. Wouldn't surprise me.
I heard Matan was like
quoting an Eglay Tal.
Yeah, he was talking about Hilchos Shabbos because like someone's definitely like pulling something, just turning some paper, and he was going like segregation.
Yeah, because they learn Shabbos and Gush Esir. Yeah. He knows his stuff. So what? Well, good. Good education. So the the Avni Nezer, the Sukkachavara. Sorry. So his Hakdama is beautiful, and I recommend it to you, even if you're not learning Hilchos Shabbos. I recommend the whole sefer, no matter what. But the Hakdama is about the notion of joy in Talmud Torah, relevant to what we were talking about earlier. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece, and he talks about the importance of Simcha, and he brings a lot of rayos for the idea. Right, Taras Hashem Tzimima. Right, the Torah is Mesamche Lev, and the idea in general. It says that mitzvos lav vehatnos nitnu, mitzvos are given for hana'a, with the exception of Talmud Torah, based on the position of the Bach, and he brings other rayos for this idea that many mitzvos, their essence is not focused on simcha, but Talmud Torah is, that's its very core, it's very heart and soul, it's a prima godin like that. There's other evidence for this idea as well. Anyhow, so in the Avni Nezer, in Orach Chaim 7 Shin Pei Dalet, he says another svara. He says like this. He says that, what's the pshat in the Ramban? He says the reason the mitzvah says shalos man grama, because even though in practice it's limited to certain amounts of time and to a certain calendar period, it's not fundamentally a function of time. What is it a function of? All right, it's a function of korban to korban. It's dependent not on calendar time, but on an event. An event that, yes, granted, happens to take place on a particular date on the calendar, and it's preparing for or leading toward another event that, granted, in Achinami is linked to certain times on the calendar, but fundamentally, in its essence, it's not a function of time, it's a function of counting from korban to korban. Right? And therefore, right? And, right, it says, therefore, it's not in zman tesa zayin benisan gore. It's not a function of time per se, says the Avni Nezer. Therefore, it's not a mitzvah sesesh as man grama. So again, I would say something similar to what we said by Mila. If we were viewing this from purely practical perspective, so then this doesn't make very much sense at all. Right? It doesn't fit. However, if again you're viewing it through a practical, through a more abstract or theoretical lens, again, either like a Kirfersh or just as an independent legal category, then again, you can begin to see the svara of the Avni Nezer. Right? So what's the machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban? You might say it's a machlokes about the nature of Shiras HaOmer, although in the Rambam seems to emphasize that it's really from the Chiyuv HaOmer. I would say Ketzira HaOmer, it's separate shir from the Chiyuv HaOmer to the Chiyuv Shehalachan. So that might be difficult, or maybe they disagree about the Rambam is more practical, the Ramban perhaps more theoretical. It's at least a possible reading among others of the Machlokas. Similarly, just to rush, because we are again low on time, one might understand Kiddush Levana in a similar way. So that's E. I'm skipping a little bit. So the question, are women obligated in Kiddush Levana? So the Pashtus is that women are exempt. And the reason I say the Pashtus is that women are exempt is because women traditionally, historically, simply, to the best of my knowledge, did not recite Kiddush Levana. So it seems difficult to condemn all women for much of Jewish history who have not performed Kiddush Levana if they're obligated in that. But it's not in Shulchan Aruch, and to the best of my knowledge, it's not in the Mishnah, it is in the Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham is Sim Tav Chavav, which is the Siman in Or HaChaim that talks about the mitzvah. Kiddush Levana writes explicitly in the name of the Shlach Kadosh that Nashim Turos the mitzvah Sesesha Asman Grama. Who? That women are exempt because it's the mitzvah Sesesha Asman Grama, and despite the surprising practical halachic argument, which we don't generally accept, but the Chacham Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Kluger, which was, did we mention him recently? I think we mentioned him recently.
familiar.
I can't remember when we mentioned it. In any of the show, Rishon Kluger, maybe I just mentioned that we're going to quote Rishon Kluger here. I think that's probably, yeah. So Chacham HaShlomo disagrees with this, and he thinks that there's good reason to think that this is a problematic svara. Now, the way that he says it, he says very interesting. He says, Mitzvah Sasesha Azman Grama means a mitzvah whose guf is present. There's some physical possibility of performing the mitzvah all year long or what have you for a longer period of time than the mitzvah actually exists. So like you can bake matzah and have a chepza shel matzah a year long, there's a mitzvah eat at a certain time. Therefore, I would have exempted women from the mitzvah of matzah had there not been a gzeirah shavah between chametz and matzah, for example, and things like that. But when it comes to Kiddush Levana, he says, the mitzvah is haroa levana bechidusha. If you see a new moon. So if you see a new moon, there's no chepza shel mitzvah. So he says, it's not zman grama. If it's not zman grama, it's not caused by time. It's that there's no chepza shel mitzvah outside of a certain time period. So that, so he says that's not a mitzvah saseh shazman grama. I heard a variation of this svara, and one could suggest a variation of this svara based on what we've seen before, which is to say that Kiddush Levana is true, happens at a certain time of month, but it is not triggered by time per se, it is rather triggered by an astronomical phenomenon. And therefore, again, conceptually, it's not a mitzvah to say Shazman Grama. The common denominator between the Chacham HaShlomo and the variation that we're just offered is to say that essentially, again, it's not practical. We look at it conceptually, theoretically. So Zman Grama means literally Zman Grama. The fact that practically she's exempt is beside the point. So again, that would be a similar svara. Time is tight, so let me just wrap up some loose ends very quickly. We noted earlier with regard to Chiyuv Sheish Bo Kares, Mitzvah Sheish Bo Kares, that Tosa seemed to say that if it's really important, then maybe we think that women are going to be obligated. And that is, about to lose the recording, so if you're listening at any other point in the history of humanity, so you might miss just a couple of minutes, but we're wrapping up soon. And that's the sugya about women's obligation in Tefillah. Right? Because the Gemara says, in our Girsa, right, the Rif and the Rambam seem to have had a different Girsa. What?
I'm not going to use the Girsa to say some time.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to have time. What?
I'm reciting a Bracha.